Sunrise doesn't last all morning. A cloudburst doesn't last all day. Seems my love is up and has left you with no warning. It's not always been this great. All things must pass. All things must pass away. Sunset doesn't last all evening. A mind can blow those clouds away. After all this, my love is up and must be leaving. It's not always been this great. All things must pass. All things must pass away. Another day, our darkness only stays the night time. In the morning it will fade away. Daylight is good at arriving at the right time. It's not always gonna be this great. Pass away. All things must pass. All things must pass away.
Brian Epstein was dead. We were lost. Maharishi was calm.
He told us that not to get overwhelmed by grief and to whatever thoughts we have of Brian, to keep them happy.
Watch out now, take a beware for falling swingers. Dropping all around you. That often mingles in your fingertips. Beware of darkness. Watch out now, take a beware, thoughts that linger. Winding up inside your head. The hopelessness around you. In the dead night. You are here for. Watch out now, take a beware. soft shoe shufflers. Dancing down the sidewalk as each unconscious sufferer wanders aimlessly. Watch out now, take up your world, greedy leaders. They take you where you should not go. While weeping at the cedars, they just wanna grow.
He was a rather rotund little man in a white robe with long hair and a big beard that was white at the tip. He invited us to stay with him at his ashram in India. In February 1968, with half the world's press, we set off for Rishikesh. John, George and Paul wrote several songs while we were there, and several went into the Beatles' White Album. Ringo and Maureen stayed for only 2 weeks. Maureen had a phobia about flies.
The happy Rishikesh song. All you need to do is to say still a word.
Jane left after about a month, keen to get back to London and Apple, the new business the Beatles were about to launch. The two who were most engrossed in Maharishi's teachings were John and George. Then everything went horribly wrong. Mia Farrow told John she thought Maharishi had been behaving inappropriately. I think he made a pass at her. John threw a hissy fit and said, "Come on, we're leaving." Perhaps John had been waiting for an excuse to leave. He wanted to be with Yoko Ono.
All you got to do is say this little word. I know it's time to serve, but it's true. The magic's in the mantra. We'll give you all the answers. Just swallow this, that's all you gotta do. Take 3 times a day after every meal.
Whatever the truth, they left. We stayed on, but the next night I had a horrid dream about Maharishi. I said, "Come on, we're leaving."
All you need to do is to say this little word. I know it sounds absurd, but it's true. The magic's in the mantra. We'll give you all the answers. So swallow this, that's all you gotta do.
George didn't want to go straight from 2 months of meditation into the chaos that was waiting for him in England. The new business, finding a new manager, the fans and the press. Instead, we went to see Ravi Shankar and lost ourselves. And yet from the time we left India, our lives and our relationship seemed to fall apart. George retreated into himself. He continued the meditation and the chanting, and to begin with, so did I. But he became obsessive about it. Some days he would be all right, but other days he seemed withdrawn and depressed. And there were other women. That really hurt. In India, George Bhagavata had become fascinated by the god Krishna, who was always surrounded by young maidens, and came back wanting to be like him, a spiritual being with lots of concubines. He actually said so, and no woman was out of bounds. But ours wasn't the only relationship in trouble. John had met Yoko Ono. She was everything that Cynthia was not. Anarchic, original, afraid of nothing. John said he had never known love like it. She seemed to take the place of everyone else in his life. John walked out on Cynthia and their son Julian. He married Yoko in March 1969. Meanwhile, Paul and Jane's relationship, which everyone had thought would end in marriage, had also hit the buffers. Not long afterwards, Paul met Linda Eastman, an American photographer. She had a daughter from a previous marriage and was reluctant to commit again, but eventually Paul persuaded. The 12th of March 1969 is ingrained on my memory. It was the day Paul and Linda were married at Marylebone Register Office. Also the day on which our worst nightmare came true. We didn't go to the wedding. Paul hadn't invited any of the Beatles. I was on my own at home in Esher when suddenly the bell rang. I opened the door to find a crowd of uniformed policemen and a dog standing outside. The man in charge introduced himself as Detective Sergeant Pilcher from Scotland Yard. I knew why he was there. He thought we had drugs and he said he was going to search the house. I rang George at Apple and said, "The police are here. Come home." Suddenly, Sergeant Pilcher appeared and said, "Look what Yogi, our dog, has found." He produced a block of hash. I said, "Are you mad? You brought that with you." He denied it and said, "Yogi found it in one of your husband's shoes." I told him, "This is a joke. If you'd said at the start you were looking for cannabis, I would have told you it's in the sitting room on the table in a pot. Thought you meant heroin or something dangerous. Why are you doing this?" Eventually, George arrived and Sergeant Pilcher arrested us both. We were taken to Esher Police Station, where we were fingerprinted and formally charged, but released on bail. Sergeant Pilcher went on to arrest a whole range of musicians, Keith Richards, Brian Jones and Donovan. A few months before he busted us, he had raided John and Yoko. After 3 weeks, we appeared in court. As I recorded in my diary, "Fined £500, the bastards." The real problem about being convicted for John and Yoko and us was that afterwards it became difficult to get into America and New Zealand. Sergeant Pilcher got his comeuppance. Not only did John immortalise him as Semolina Pilchard, years later he was sentenced to 4 years in prison for corruption.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how. Somewhere in the smile she knows I don't need no other lover. Something in her style that shows me. And I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how. I don't know.
By the end of 1969, the Beatles as such had virtually ceased to exist. Their company, Apple, was another bone of contention. They were musicians, not businessmen. George was bringing home bad vibes. We would argue and bicker, and he spent more and more time away from home. Eric Clapton. I was aware that Eric found me attractive. I enjoyed the attention he paid me. It was hard not to be flattered when I caught him staring at me, or when he chose to sit beside me, or engaged me in conversation. Those were the things that George no longer did. George and I had been together for 5 years, married for 3. Although we still loved each other, life was not idyllic. George decided he wanted to move. He wanted a large garden and a house big enough for him to convert part of it into a recording studio. For about a year, I drove around the countryside, looking at one grand house after another. Sometimes George came with me. Most of the time it was Terry Doran, his assistant and general factotum. Terry had known the Beatles since Liverpool days. He had started off in the motor trade and was immortalised in the song She's Leaving Home. I adored him. He was someone I could always talk to when George was being difficult or withdrawn. We searched and searched, and one Sunday our estate agent spotted a tiny ad in the Sunday Times, placed by some nuns for a house called Friar Park near Henley-on-Thames, Oxfordshire. I went to see it, and it was like something out of a fairy tale, built of red brick and stone. It stood proudly on a hill. It was the most beautiful place I had ever seen in my life. When George saw it the next day, he flipped and we put in an offer straight away. Eventually, we bought it for £140,000. But this for a house on 3 floors with 25 bedrooms, a ballroom, a drawing room, a dining room, a library, a huge kitchen and hall, intricate carvings, formal gardens of 10 or 12 acres, and a further 20 acres of land. There were 2 lodges and a gatehouse. It was certainly big enough. The whole house was in a state of terrible disrepair. We became passionate about restoring the house and gardens to their former glory. In March 1970, we moved in, George, Terry and I, and immediately brought in an architect who oversaw the project, starting with the top floor. The house was basically uninhabitable, so we moved into Middle Lodge for a few months until the main house was ready. One morning, I opened a letter addressed to Patty Harrison, Friar Park. I read, "It seems like an eternity since I last saw or spoke to you. He needed to ascertain my feelings. Did I still love my husband? Did I still have feeling in my heart for him? He had to know and urged me to write to tell him. Please do this, whatever it may say. My mind will be at rest. All my love, E." I read it quickly and assumed it was from some weirdo. It was Eric Clapton. I had no idea you felt that way. It made the flirtation all the more exciting and dangerous. I felt uncomfortable that he was pushing me in a direction I wasn't certain I wanted to go. I could no longer resist. George came over to us and said, "What's going on?" To my complete horror, Eric said, "I have to tell you, man, that I'm in love with your wife. I wanted to die. George was furious. He turned to me and said, "Well, are you going with him or coming with me?" And I said, "George, I'm coming home." I followed him to his car. We got into it and he sped off. When we got home, I went to bed and he disappeared into his recording studio. George was away. I said, "Eric, are you mad? I can't possibly. I'm married to George." He went. I hardly saw him for 3 years. I turned my attention to Friar Park and to my husband. For a brief period, the project united us, but the house was so enormous and there were always so many people living in it. We never had the intimacy we had enjoyed at Kinfauns. It took about 4.5 years to restore the house. It was a lot of work and George put a huge amount of money into it. Friar Park lifted his spirits. At Kinfauns, I'd felt that I had a say in it. At Fry Park, I didn't. I felt it was George's house. He would make the decisions. I did a lot of the furnishing, but I never felt the house was truly ours. We had some great dinner parties, plenty of wine, and afterwards everyone would sit around and smoke dope. From time to time, there would be some cocaine. George developed an extreme relationship with cocaine. He was either using it every day or not at all for months at a stretch. Then he would be spiritual and clean and would meditate for hour after hour with no chance of normality. Then he would stop meditating, snort coke and have fun, flirting and partying. Although it was more companionable, there was no normality in that either. George really didn't like going out, so we stayed in that great house and became gradually detached from reality. We didn't listen to the radio because George wouldn't let us, and we didn't have newspapers, and the people who came to see us were either musicians or worked for Apple. The house and garden became an obsession with George, and he seemed to want to do it alone. It was the same with the spirituality. He had left me behind. Maybe I had chosen to be left behind. There is no doubt that George was going through a difficult time. Having had such a structured life as a Beatle, he was on his own and uncertain of what the future might hold. When he eventually recorded a solo album, he was nervous about it, but he didn't talk to me. He went to Terry Doran, who became our go-between. We were living in a surreal world with a very creative and eccentric person. I didn't see or speak to Eric again until 1971 at the concert for Bangladesh in Madison Square Garden. George knew that Eric was in a bad way. He thought that if he got him on stage, even propped up with drugs, his friends might be able to help him. He was very out of it. Eric began to profess his love for me with increasing vigour. Meanwhile, George and I had been going from bad to worse. In the spring of 1973, he went to Spain, supposedly to see Salvador Dali, with Ronnie Wood's wife, Chrissy. In hindsight, I wonder whether George's pursuit of other women was a challenge. Perhaps he was hoping to provoke me, to make me put my foot down and reclaim him. The final straw was his affair with Maureen Starr, Ringo's wife. She was the last person I would have expected to stab me in the back. But she did. She wasn't even prepared to be subtle. Maureen would turn up at Fry Park at midnight and say, "I've come to listen to George playing in the studio." And I'd say, "Well, I'm going to bed." The next morning, she'd still be there. I'd say, "Have you thought about your children? What are you up to? I don't like it." Her answer? Tough. On the 23rd of June that year, Eric came round to Fry Park. He took me aside and pleaded with me once more to leave George. I felt swamped, lost and confused. But now I had to make a choice. Would I go to Eric, who had been to hell and back in the last 3 years because of me? Or would I choose George, my husband, whom I had loved, who had been cold and indifferent towards me for so long? On the 3rd of July, I told George I was leaving him. I said we were leading a ludicrous and hateful life and I was going to Los Angeles to stay with my sister Jenny and her husband Mick Fleetwood. When George came to bed, he said, "Don't go." Half of me wanted to stay, but I was at the end of my tether. I must have weighed about 8 stone and I was really, really thin. I said, "I'm going." The next day, with great sadness in my heart, I packed some things, said a tearful goodbye to our 2 Siamese cats, then flew to America. What I had felt for George was a great, deep love.
Okay, here we go, fellas. Got a B-side to make, ladies and gentlemen. Yep.
garbage time now, so we better get right on with it. I don't care anymore. More Jews on the phones, and I'll kick down anybody's door. So hold you in my arms once more. I'll go anywhere, you know I don't want to. Yeah. If your man should get uptight, 'cause we've been alone for most of the night. Now I realize you need our right. Gonna get back up them stairs, you know I don't care. There's a line that I can draw.
Yes, I'm Patty Boyd.